Good evening, everyone. Everyone awake and ready? Everyone awake and ready?
Yes.
Good. Please pray with me. Oh, Heavenly Father.
Oh, Heavenly Father.
Divine Mother.
Divine Mother.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Beloved Jesus Christ.
Blessed Master.
Blessed Master.
Dearest Mother.
Dearest Mother.
Saints and sages of all religions.
Saints and sages of all religions.
I bow to all of you. Free my life from all obstacles.
Free my life from all obstacles.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
And give me physical, mental, and spiritual development.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my mind thy temple.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my heart thy altar.
Make my love thy home.
Make my love thy home.
Be thou the only king.
Be thou the only king.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Reigning on the throne of my consciousness.
Peaceless. Amen. Bobby recently gave me this book entitled Fingerprints of God by Barbara Bradley Haggerty, The Search for the Science of Spirituality. She's a reporter, and she was interested in spirituality and wanted to interview a variety of people around this. So I thought this would be interesting in this one reading that I have here. She interviewed Scott McDermott, who is a minister, a theologian, who had an experience at one point in what is sometimes called a spirit-filled church. And he went through an initiation-type experience at that time when he felt this tremendous power come over him during this service, and he had a vision. And in this vision, he was running through Israel and by various locations that he knew about, including the Mount of Olives. And finally, he came to the finish line, and there was Jesus. And the experience that he had was one of complete love and acceptance. And it was a life-changing experience for him, but it was one that he had prepared himself through much prayer. So she had interviewed him and thought about him during these years. I thought about Scott McDermott often over the next 3 years because he possessed an uncommon combination of qualities, the polished intellect of a scholar and the all-consuming spirituality of a mystic. What was more, Scott practiced the presence of God, and his long daily prayers seemed to give him access to another reality. When I read in Newsweek that a scientist was studying the brains of Buddhist monks and Catholic nuns, I thought of Scott. What was going on in Scott's brain when he connected with God, I wondered. When he saw the Kidron Valley or heard the voice of Jesus, I could not wait to get his brain scanned. On June 1, 2007, Scott and I met in the radiology department at the hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. We chatted for a few minutes, then followed a nurse down the hall to a cul-de-sac of examination rooms and one brain scanner. This was Andy Newberg's kingdom. Andy Newberg is an associate professor in the Department of Radiology, with secondary appointments in psychiatry and religious studies at the University of Pennsylvania. He is in his early 40s, but looks 24. Curly dark hair, has flecks of gray, but the rest of him cries out that the gray is an optical illusion. He gives the impression of a seventh grader who went to bed thinking about his geometry test and awoke the next morning to find himself a neuroscientist. Newberg had authored 3 books and countless articles on neurotheology, the study of the brain in the throes of spiritual experience, Why God Won't Go Away, which he wrote with his friend and mentor, the late Eugene D'Aquila, explored the events in people's brains when they enjoy mystical experiences. This is the research that made the cover of Newsweek, the story that rendered me sleepless for a week. Another Newberg book, Why We Believe What We Believe, looked at the different types of mystical experience, including speaking in tongues and the meditation of an atheist. He proposed a theory of why we seek our religious experience and how the experience cements our beliefs about God and the nature of reality. Newberg is a rock star in the small world of neurotheology, and certainly among the media, even though fellow neurologists sometimes tut-tut about the gleeful abandon with which he exposes the human brain. Newberg doesn't seem to care. He traveled way too far into the brain to turn back now. For the past few years, Newberg has studied spiritual experts of all stripes, Tibetan Buddhist monks, Franciscan nuns, Sikhs, Pentecostals, in other words, those who practice prayer and meditation long and hard. I had already witnessed him measuring the brain wave activity and scanning the brain of a Sikh while he chanted his prayers. And on the first day of June 2007, I would watch as he scanned the brain of a Christian in prayer, my minister friend, Scott McDermott. One mystery about spiritually inclined people is this. What turns people into spiritual virtuosos? I have come to think that people like Scott McDermott are to prayer what Tiger Woods is to golf. From an early age, their natural talents channeled them toward golf or toward God, and once they felt the rush of watching that ball fall into the hole or sipping the unearthly wine of transcendence, they pursued their passions. They trained because the reward was so sweet and so constant. Nature and nurture, genes and sweat, schemed to create these masters. Scott was 16 when he says he first encountered God directly. From that time on, prayer became the central habit of his life, around which all other events orbited. Scott has prayed 1 to 2 hours a day for more than 35 years. On Fridays, his day off, when he is often on his knees for 4. During those sessions, Scott feels peace and joy. He says he often hears a voice and receives visions. I begin early, he told me. I began at 5:30. I'm not a morning person. I stumble down to my basement, my study down in the basement. I have a recliner down there. I walk down, turn the lights on, and I say, God, it's just me. I just want to spend some time with you. And I sit in the chair, and we begin to have a conversation. I turn to Andy Newberg, who is standing with us in a small examination room in the hospital. Newberg was listening intently. I'm curious, Andy, what would that kind of practice do to the brain, I ask. Well, some of the research we have been doing suggests that when people are engaged in practices over a long period of time, it does ultimately alter how the person's brain functions. As one does a particular practice or a particular task over and over, that becomes more and more written in the neural connections of the brain. So the more you focus on something, whether it's math or auto racing or football or God, the more that becomes your reality. I glanced at Scott to see if he picked up on the ambivalence in Newberg's response. God may well be your reality and still be imaginary. The belief in God may shape your worldview and your brain, and in the same way, Harry Potter books shape the brains and imaginations of children. But no one would argue that the wizard, like Harry Potter, actually exists. I put the question to Newberg more explicitly. When people pray, do they connect to God or tap into a dimension outside of their bodies? Newberg was prepared with a careful answer. Well, it comes down to belief systems, he said. What a religious person looks at our brain scans, they say, oh, that's where God has an interaction with me. An atheist looks at the data and says, there it is. It's nothing more than what's in your brain. Even if I do a brain scan of somebody who tells me that they've seen God, that scan only tells me what their brains are doing when they had that experience, and it doesn't tell me whether or not they actually did see God. In fact, Newberg is undecided as to whether brain images reveal there is a God or not. Materialists would say that the brain scans prove that prayer is a physical process, nothing more. There is no need to bring an external being into the equation. But Newberg points out that the brain scans do not necessarily exclude an external being. Say you are eating a piece of apple pie, just out of the oven, topped with melted vanilla ice cream. If Newberg took a brain scan of you as you bit into the pie, various parts of your brain would light up. The areas that register smell, taste, form, and shape, as would the area that recalls the memory of your time you tasted pie this good at the country fair when you were 6 years old. The parts of your brain not involved with the task would go dark. Who knows? You may even sense a self in the ecstatic culinary moment. But just because your brain is activated in this way does not mean that the apple pie isn't real. Of course it's real. And just because Scott McDermott's prayers correlate to brain activity, does that mean God is a mere illusion? Newberg then announced it was time for the study to begin. He closed the door and instructed Scott to relax in a metal bed in the sterile, cool room as a nurse inserted a catheter into his arm. They dimmed the lights. After 10 minutes, Newberg tiptoed into the room and started the IV. Radioactive tracer began to flow into Scott's arm and up into his brain. After the tracer had set, Newberg led Scott to the brain imaging machine, which would take a snapshot of Scott's brain. Scott lay down with his head in the machine. It was chilly in the room. The nurse tucked him in with a little blanket. For the next 45 minutes, Scott rested with his head secured in a place by the pillows while the machine rotated around his head, taking images of his brain. The brain scanner then developed a color-coded picture of his brain. The active parts were red hot and screaming for attention, while the ho-hum areas were yellow and the sleeping areas were a cool blue. Scott went through the routine twice. The first time, Newberg told Scott not to pray, but to allow his thoughts to wander, to remember a movie he saw or chores that he had to do. He could think about anything but God. This scan would produce a baseline, a testing state image. In the second session, Scott prayed intensely for a particular person in what's called intercessory prayer. Like those weight loss advertisements, Newberg would analyze the before and after, comparing the baseline image with the image of the brain in the act of prayer. Excuse me. After Scott emerged from the second brain scan, Newberg and Scott and I gathered in the examination room. Did you have any visual or auditory sensations? I asked, thinking of his vision of running from Jericho to Jerusalem. Yes, I did, for some of that. What sort of thing? I asked. "I'm not sure you want this on tape," Scott said, laughing. It turned out he had been praying for me. He had a vision that God wanted to shatter the molds that I had put myself into. As a wife, the mold of a reporter, the mold of various parts, and so on. That God had a special mold for me. And I saw God handing you this mold of who you are, how He's made you. He says, "That is how I want you to be." It was intense, Barb. I would have screamed if I could have. It was that intense. Newberg nodded thoughtfully. "We did a study recently of people speaking in tongues, and the whole concept in hearing what God has to say and feeling the Spirit of God going through them. That sensation was caught on the brain scan." "So given your research," I asked, "what are some of the things you might expect on Scott's scan?" Newberg was uncertain. Scott's prayer life seemed to straddle the two types of states that Newberg had studied. One type involved meditative practice, a state of mind a little like a champion dressage horse under perfect control. The other involved ecstatic Pentecostal prayer, which bucked and snorted like a rodeo bull. Which sort of brain Scott possessed would remain a mystery for several weeks. So far, Newberg had identified two types of virtuoso brains: contemplative brains and rowdy brains. Let's examine the contemplative first. For this study, Newberg put Franciscan nuns and Tibetan Buddhist monks, separately of course, into the brain scanner of the University of Pennsylvania. The theologies underpinning these two practices have nothing in common. During their centering prayer, a meditative prayer that emphasized interior silence, the nuns focused intently on God, and usually on Jesus. During the meditation, the monks nestled into a state of intense awareness, connecting with the underlying reality of life. Their belief systems excludes supernatural external God. Yet each group's descriptions of their transcendent moments bore an uncanny resemblance. "I felt communion, peace, openness to experience," Sister Celeste, a charming 70-year-old Franciscan nun, recalled after emerging from the imaging machine. "She felt an awareness and a responsiveness to God's presence around me, and a feeling of centering, quieting, nothingness, as well as moments of fullness of the presence of God. God was permeating my being." Now listen to Michael Blaine's words. Blaine is a Tibetan Buddhist and a scientist who works with Andy Newberg and became one of the subjects in the study. Blaine described his meditation's experience as timeless and infinite. "There was an intense feeling of love," Blaine told Newberg. "I felt a profound letting go of the boundaries around me and a connection with the kind of energy and state of being that had the quality of clarity, transparency, and joy. I felt a deep and profound sense of connection to everything, recognizing that there never was a true separation at all. It sounded to me like two different road trips. One group drives a Lexus through the redwood forests, and the other takes an Escalade through the Swiss Alps. The vehicles looked entirely dissimilar, as do the scenery, but gazing at the giant trees and the towering mountains may stir up similar sense of exhilaration or awe." For Andy Newberg, the question was this: what was going on under the hood? Are the brain mechanics the same for Catholic nuns and Buddhist monks as they experience the transcendent? Just two different cars in two different countries operating along the same mechanical principles? That is precisely what Newberg discovered when he peered into their brain scans. With both the monks and the nuns, the front part of the brains lit up as they focused on the task at hand. Think of the frontal lobes as the chief operating officer of the brain, With one accountant-like tendency, it handles the details, helps plan and execute tasks, keeps you awake and alert, and above all, focused. It also possesses memory and language, and other complicated social tasks such as figuring out how to behave at a cocktail party or how to respond to your spouse or friend or rival at work. As the Christian nuns focused on God, one word like Jesus or Ilium that helped them connect to the divine. Their frontal lobes shifted into overdrive. Similarly, as Buddhist monks meditated on an image that allowed them to connect with the ground of being, their scan showed their frontal lobes as a red glow of anxiety. A red glow of activity. Newberg found another peculiar similarity. With both the nuns and the monks, the parietal lobes were dark during the deep prayer and meditation. Newberg calls this orientation area because it orients you in space and time. Those lobes tell you your body ends and the rest of the world begins. That is why Sister Celeste and countless other mystics described a unity with God, or as she put it, God permeating my being. It was the neurological reason that Michael Blaine felt a deep and profound sense of connection to everything, recognizing that there never was a true separation at all. And I might add, it was those who enjoyed psychedelic drugs and natural mystic experience reported. Newberg theorizes that when the nuns and the monks focused on their mantra or image, their brains simply screened out other information. You're watching Casablanca and the oven timer goes off. Or you're going rapturously at your beloved and the phone rings. You don't notice. Increase that 100-fold and you would lose your sense of time and space. It's not that the orientation area of the brain is not working. Rather, the frontal lobes are physically blocking all the information going to the orientation area. The sounds, the sights, the dog at the door, and the timer in the kitchen, the things that would normally create a picture of the world around you. Yet the orientation area, conscientious beaver as it is, still trying to tell you its job. It's still trying to create for you a sense of yourself and spatial relation between you and the rest of the world, Newberg says. But it has been deprived of the information that it normally has to do that. So you wind up with this sense of no self, no space, no time. Newberg's description reminded me of the way psychedelic drugs may behave in a brain to create hallucinations. Some pharmacologists believe that drugs like psilocybin block out external sensory information, allowing you to create your own transcendent reality. Chemicals are quicker, but it may be that prayer and meditation accomplish the same high without the potential for a bad trip or ending up in handcuffs. For me personally, Newberg's brain scans are a theological dynamite. They boil down to this: a mystical state is a mystical state. The closer one draws to a transcendent state, or as Newberg calls it, absolute unitary being, the more the descriptions merge. Christian mystics sound like Sufi mystics, who sound like Jewish mystics, who sound like Buddhists. And from the brain's point of view, this makes perfect sense. Buddhists and Hindus and Christians and Jews who have mystical states tend to describe these states as everything becomes one. The same term keeps cropping up over and over again. Newberg told me that when you look at the physiology of the brains, the most unitary state is one in which we completely deprive the orientation parts of the brain of information. So physiologically, it should be very similar. And philosophically, it should also be similar. If you have totally undifferentiated experience, it's undifferentiated. It really has to be the same regardless of where you're coming from. It doesn't matter if you scale a spiritual peak using Christian centering prayer, Buddhist meditations, or Sikh chanting. The destination is the same. Or, as Sophie Burnham might tell you, you must choose a spoke to get to the center of the wheel, but any spoke will do. Newberg's research throws a gauntlet at the foot of my faith. If disparate religions drive the same neural routes to transcendence, can one religion claim to be true and all others false, or at least deficient? I had noticed my own reporting that people who experience mystical states tended to drop religion labels if they had been Christian before, then they often became spiritual but not religious afterwards, and they might incorporate other traditions into their practice of Christianity. One thing they often rejected, however, was an exclusive claim to truth. This forced me to reconsider Jesus' statement, "I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me." Perhaps, I reflected, Jesus' words were more nuanced than a literal reading of the text suggests. Of course, I was not ready to throw my faith overboard just yet because of a few brain scans. Even if two things appear identical physiologically, they can play out in distinct ways. Identical twins share the same DNA, but they are not identical people. Can one routinely score can one routinely score 100 on math tests and the other flunk? Can one become a car salesman and the other an English teacher? Of course. Biology does not determine everything, and it certainly cannot determine the nature of truth. In the same way, it is too facile to say that the brain states can determine the veracity of spiritual claims. And yet, I wondered, if there is a God who maps out the neural routes to communicate with Him, He could be making an explicit point. Maybe the distinctions between religions are more artificial than believers want to admit. So I think that's very interesting. And there's a lot being said within that article, of course. I have worked with psychiatrists and others who are big believers in biology. And there is a basic fundamental difference between those who believe totally and completely in the physiological explanations for consciousness, for mind, and for human experience, and those in particular contrast who look at life from a spiritual perspective. From a spiritual perspective, the brain is not the originator of experience. The brain is a vehicle for the soul or spirit to experience life through that particular physical body. And just like when you're trying to use a bit of machinery or some mechanism, and the mechanism is working all right, and you push the right buttons, and everything goes along just so, and you're very happy with things. If something happens within that machinery or that mechanism, you push the buttons and it doesn't happen in the way that you expect it to. Perhaps nothing at all, or perhaps the wrong thing happens. And even so, the soul that's operating through this body and through this brain depends on this brain and this body operating as it should in order to express itself fully and completely. If the brain were to suffer a stroke, for instance, then that would take away the functioning of that brain, and the soul would not be able to fully express itself through that body and through that mind. Now, this in no way affects the totality of the soul. The soul doesn't lose that functioning, but the body does. And the same is true whether you lose a limb or have some other malfunction within the body. The soul isn't able then to express itself fully through a body that is not able to operate in that way. And yet, the soul, the spirit of that one, is complete and full as it ever was. There was a time when Mother Hamilton was taking on a lot of karma for the disciples as well as the world at large. That was part of the reason why she came. And in doing so, she incurred different sufferings of the body. That was a way that a great master can help to work out the karma of the disciples and of the world at large. And during those experiences, she had a heart attack, and then she had a terrible case of the shingles, and she had a series of strokes. After suffering through several of those things, I went to a nursing home to see Mother, where she was in a temporary stay there while she was recovering from some of these things. And I walked into the room, and I saw there Mother, who looked very tiny at the time. She was a small woman, but normally her energy field was so vast that I never did think of her as being small. But she looked small in the wheelchair that she was in. She had had the strokes, and one side of her face was paralyzed, and there was some drool coming down on that side of the mouth. One side hung limp, as you have seen other stroke victims have the same kind of thing. She had had shingles in the face, and so she had these open wounds and sores all along her face, and it was completely red. Her face was exactly split down the middle, with the shingles on one side, and the other side looked totally normal. Her eye had swollen so much from the shingles that they were afraid the eye was going to explode, and so they had sewn a thin piece of membrane skin over the eye to keep it from exploding. You can kind of get the picture. She was in tough shape physically. And when I saw her in that nursing home setting, it wasn't a particularly nice nursing home. It was all right, but of course there's many people there who had dementia and who were calling out and crying out, people who were just lying in beds in the hallway and so on. And in a way, it looked like a kind of Dante's Inferno that I was walking through. And here I came in and I saw Mother. And I think that she recognized me, but I'm not sure. And she didn't have much control over her functions of the body, so her speech was so slurred that she was very difficult to understand. Now this, coming from a woman who was the most powerful individual I've ever met in my life. And I oftentimes thought in meeting Mother that it was like meeting a head of state, what it must feel like to meet a head of state, although I understand that that's a very disappointing experience for most people when they actually meet the head of state. But Mother was a powerhouse, spiritually and on a personal plane. And now I saw her in this state, and it shook me. And I didn't understand. And so I had the time, so I went home after I saw her. I sat down on my familiar meditation blanket, and I took the question to God, what in the world was going on here? What has happened to Mother? And why is she like this now when she had been such a powerful figure before? And so I sat for quite some time in meditation with that deepening prayer and that deepening question. And slowly, slowly, all of the calm began to set in. And then suddenly, I had a vision, and in that vision, I saw Mother in her light body, and she was beautiful, and she was resplendent with light, and the light shone in every direction as far as the eye could see. And she was more magnificent and more powerful and more beautiful than I'd ever seen her before. And as I pronounced mentally to her, and bowing at her feet, and she said, "Don't you know I'm in my light body?" And it took away all of that doubt that had been created in my mind, all of that uncertainty, whatever there had been, that question that had been there, and I knew for a fact that she was not the body. The body was a vehicle for her soul and for her spirit, but in no way defined who she was as a soul, any more than Jesus up on the cross would define him as a helpless being nailed to a cross, or the many other kinds of images that can come to mind about great masters and great saints and the suffering that they went through. They did that for the world. They did it for out of their love for God, because they wanted to help this world. Once during Mother's experiences, she was lifted up, and in that uplifted experience, she was looking down upon this earth. And she realized that she had gone through all the experiences that were required in order to completely release her in this lifetime. She was a fully and completely realized master. This is a rare experience in the world. There are many great saints. There are many great spiritually illumined beings, but there are very few who have completed their total and complete realization where they are completely free of the physical karma, of the astral karma, and the causal karma. And this was her state. And she realized that she was free to do whatever she could do, wanted to do. She could drop the body then at that moment and free herself from any participation in this world and go into the great beyond. But she looked down upon this world and she thought of the suffering in this world. She thought of those who are searching for that truth, for that freedom, for that emancipation that she now experienced. And her heart went out to all those who were searching and not finding. And out of compassion, she wanted to go back to this world, come back to this world, and serve in whatever way God would have her serve. And she oftentimes said, when she described the mystical crucifixion that she went through, and she went through a tremendous mystical crucifixion, because actually she was born into this world without any karma. She came down voluntarily out of compassion and love for this world. So she went through a much more difficult version of the mystical crucifixion, and she assured us of this many times, than any of us would have to go through. But she went through every aspect of it, every element of it, and in spades. And she oftentimes said that she would go through that mystical crucifixion again if God asked her to, in a second, she, without any hesitation, as difficult, as painful, as terrible as it was for her, because she realized what she got, the freedom that she got, the total emancipation that she got, the truth that she got, direct access to the truth and knowing the truth. And because she knew what she got from that, she would willingly go through that crucifixion again. And what God showed me was that when she went through these human experiences of shingles and of stroke and of heart attacks, one after the other, that this was another form of crucifixion that she was going through. She was in the crucible of the human experience. But through that crucible, she is helping to lift those who are following after her. And she was bringing the truth. She was unafraid, and she was such a tremendous teacher to me. Because I know my own nature, and when I saw her, I knew that if I were in her shoes, I'd just want to give up. I knew that about myself. Many of us would. When people are in terrible suffering, they oftentimes say, I'd just rather just go. But that wasn't Mother's attitude. She says, I want this body to function the way that it once functioned. And amazingly enough, she didn't recover 100% functioning or that outward power, spiritual power and glory that she once had. But her physical functioning, I would say, came back about 80 or 85% of what it once was. She could play the piano again, where before she had been, as I described you, sitting in this chair, like a lump, without hardly any ability over her own body functions. She could play the piano beautifully, but I just noticed in her left hand, she didn't have quite the dexterity in her fingers that she once had. It was harder. Her mental functioning and her memory all came back. She was absolutely determined that the body functioned the way that she knew that God designed it to function, you see. And she would settle for nothing less. She was a woman of tremendous will. Tremendous will. You've never met anybody like her. And she was absolutely determined to do this. And so it embedded such a powerful message inside of myself around the determination to express God consciousness through this body, through this world, in any way that God would choose to do. To let your light so shine that those around you would glorify your Father, your Heavenly Father. And so she was unafraid, you see, unafraid. And as a result of that, she had gone through these tremendous experiences and she had come out on top. When she went through the first mystical crucifixion, she came back from India in a completely paralyzed state. They had to pick her up and put her on the train and then on the boat and then on the plane. Somebody had to comb her hair for her. This was a state of rigor mortis, as she told us, after the mystical crucifixion, after the death of the ego. And this is the way she had to go through. Now, as she said, we don't have to go through all the things that she went through. But she went through that so that we might know the truth. So that we might understand that if God puts us through some things on the way up, there's a reason for it. And also she proved that we can come out of whatever it is that we might be put through at the time. That we should emulate that same positive mindset. That we should emulate that same powerful will, because it's not just your individual will. It is your will united with God's will. And when you unite your will with God's will, you've got a powerful combination. This is the way you are designed to operate, and we should not fade back into the shadows, you see. Jesus himself said you do not light a candle and put it under a bushel or under a bush. You put it up on top of the table. You put it in a candlestick. You put it up on a hilltop where it'll do some good. It'll throw some light out. And it'll help those who are striving to get somewhere themselves towards their own realization. And this is something that you have been called into this life to do. You would not be here tonight if that were not true. You may not fully understand that yet. But that's all right. It doesn't make any difference. Because there is a force operating within you that is drawing you higher and closer to the goal. When you set your intention to become one with God, you activate higher centers within the brain. When this kundalini force starts rising up inside of you, as it did in me, it starts paving the way. I am the way, the truth, and the life, said the Master. What does this mean? The traditional meaning has come down that Jesus, as an individual and a human being, is the way. We must submit ourselves to Him and surrender ourselves to Him in order to go the way, the true way, the righteous way. But Jesus spoke of himself in two different ways. In one way, he would say, I of myself am nothing. It is my Father who doeth the works. And then he would say, I and my Father are one. Well, they seem to be contradictory statements. But they're not. Because in the one sense, he is speaking from his human self, his completely and totally surrendered self to God. I of myself am nothing. He recognizes it. It's not just a statement of trying to be humble. It is a realized truth that the life that operates through you, that the intelligence that operates through you, that every God-blessed thing you have has come directly from God. And this is the truth. And you realize as an individual, you used to think that you were at the center of the controls, that you made the decisions. but now you have united yourself with a higher intelligence and consciousness. And as a result of that, you are now operating as God, the Father, operates through you, and you are a witness to that. And then you can also say, when you have realized this state, as Jesus did, I and my Father are one. You realize that the little bubble within the sea that you used to define yourself as you, the human you, the ego you, has dissolved and you've merged into the universal you. Now, is this just simply, as was described here, that you have starved the brain of sensory stimulation and therefore you have closed down that part of your brain? No. You have withdrawn the life force from that part of the brain that functions in measuring and weighing, in time and space. And the life energy withdraws more deeply into the higher centers of the brain. And as a result, you now experience your oneness with the universal spirit of God. Now, when you're on the outside looking in, you can't tell, just even as this neurotheologist could not tell, does that mean there's a veracity around this experience as it is described? He can't say yes or no, because he can only say this part of the brain lit up and this other died down. It's interesting, but it doesn't carry any real weight with it. It's not proof. And the truth is, you will never be able to prove God in an objective way. That's the truth. It is reserved as an inner experience. So the scientists will say, well, that's just a subjective experience that can't be measured. Even with these brain scans, we can't truly measure it. We can just say this part of the brain is active and this other is passive. But it is the nature of the experience itself that proves it to you, the individual. And I be lifted, if I be lifted up, will lift up all mankind with me. When you go through that experience, you lift up all the world within you into that divine consciousness. And it proves it to you. It's not something that you're vaguely thinking about, or you suddenly have kind of a mental realization, and I say, I think that that's true. That's not sufficient. You must go all the way. And when you go all the way, you know, and you know that you know. There's no doubt left in your mind. As long as there is a doubt, you haven't gone all the way. And that is no fault of God's. That is ours to do. You must do that in order to have that full and complete realization, if that be your true goal. So this must be the way that we follow. Now, it is true that certain psychedelic drugs and certain drugs, they can emulate a spiritual experience. And there are occasions where somebody will have a psychic insight, and very occasionally they will trigger a true spiritual experience. And it may change them forever as a result, even as you may have a true spiritual experience in a dream or in a sudden experience that you have, perhaps during a traumatic time in your life. But the thing is, with a drug experience, as has been told here, number one, you're not certain where it's going to take you. It's like getting into a powerful rocket and not sure where you're going to land. You could land and shake the dust off and feel like, all right, I kind of passed the bullet on that one. And I had certain experiences with it. But they're not earned experiences. Jesus once said, you must come up by the straight and narrow way. Otherwise, you are a thief and a robber. And so you have to go the true way. And the true way is you have to earn it. The thing is, when you earn it, you can gradually, and it takes time and it takes effort. It is a pearl of great price. Make no mistake about it, and it will test you on every level of your being. But when you earn that pearl of great price, that pearl is now yours. And you have that experience constantly. You live in that experience. And you would not trade it for anything in the world. And just like Mother, who went through the mystical crucifixion and said, I'd do it again in a minute. And I agree with her. Because I have also been through that mystical crucifixion. And I would do it again in a second if God asked me to do it again. Because I know what comes as a result. And it is the truth, it is the bliss, it is the joy, it is the love, it is the light. It is the fulfillment of your heart's yearning and desire. And drugs will never give that to you. Now, those who are in the kinds of churches, and they exist in India as well as they do here, where there's a lot of emotionalism and there is an initiatory experience that can be had. Sometimes it's phony. Sometimes people get caught up in the environment of such a place. It becomes emotionally charged and it can be spiritually vibrant as well. But it's not a true experience. But this is just a preliminary experience, this being slain in the spirit and so forth. Then you have to deepen it. You have to go inside because it's not the full experience and you won't get it that way. You have to learn how to quiet the mind. You have to learn how to withdraw the life force completely from all outer aspects of the brain. And draw it up. So it's an incomplete experience that people are not taught once they've had that kind of initiation to go deeper. Now, as we read about this minister, about Scott, we see he had this disciplined life. He had this initiatory experience. And it was powerful, but then he took it further, you see. This is what must happen. And so we take it deeper. You don't have to have that kind of initiatory experience, but God will take you through whatever experiences you require. But if you will just put your mind on God, begin to meditate, begin to have this conversation with God. Just take Him, go to Him just as you are. You don't have to pretend. And nor should you, to be anything other than you are. Sometimes we want to start out perfect. And if we're not perfect, we don't think that we deserve to approach God. This is just a trick of the ego. It's a way for the ego to keep you separate from God. Just simply talk to God as you would talk to a good friend. And say, well, I have this trouble and I have that trouble and this difficulty and that. And this is how my day has gone. Just develop a friendship. Talk to God. Commune with Him. Listen for His voice. His voice doesn't always come as an auditory experience. In spirit, more often, there's a thought transference. And suddenly, in your mind, you just know. You just know. And you know that that is the voice of God. And it comes as an experience. You feel it deep within yourself. And it's moving. And it's profound. And it takes you deeper into yourself. Your true self. That is always connected with God. And so in this way, science will never prove God. They will come up with some interesting things along the way. But ultimately, only you can find God within the laboratory of your own being. And when you do, it will be the fulfillment of your heart's desire. It will fulfill everything that you've looked for from a human standpoint. Whether you've looked for it in a lover, a husband, a wife, the perfect job, the right amount of money, the prestige, the love of others, the love of family, in whatever way that you've looked for it, that will always fall short of the total and complete fulfillment of your heart's desire. Only God can fill that. And when you have that experience, it is undeniable. Undeniable.